Hey, folks, this is Ro from the Scarif Scuttlebutt podcast, where you know it's always sunny on Scarif, and you are listening to the Rebel Base Card Podcast. Great pull, kid.
Tell me what comes into your mind.
You've seen the show, and like us, you have questions.
Ooh, that was a good one, but try this one on for size.
No question should be left off your list.
Whoa, I got a crazy theory, but hear me out.
But you better have some spares.
Oh, that was one of mine. All right, let's do this instead.
With me, as always, is my friend and Card Squadron winger.
This is Greg Cass, a.k.a. Ion Cannon.
We've recorded at home and across the U.S.
Last summer, we were from the Boston Common. This week, we're in Chicago.
This is day three of celebration.
The show has had many names, but the purpose is the same. Let's share some time at the table.
Ding, ding, it's time for breakfast.
Welcome to The Breakfast Pack, a Rebel Base Card micro podcast series. A returning Star Wars insert podcast series that asks more questions than it answers. Today on Breakfast Pack number 74, we're asking questions on the Bad Batch Season 3 episodes Identity Crisis and Point of No Return that both aired on Disney Plus Wednesday, April 3rd. With me again at the breakfast table is my partner in crime and Card Squadron winger, number two, by the way, Gregory Cass from IonCannon.com. Greg, how are we doing this breakfast day?
Fantastic. I am always excited to be here and to talk about Star Wars. I don't know about you and maybe the mystery guest who's also on the line, but I'm living a Star Wars high lately. We've had so much good news, so much excitement. I think everything in the galaxy seems to be pointing towards May 4th as just a really fun time this year. So I'm high on Star Wars and high on life. And whoever you're about to introduce, I always like to say this is my two favorite internet friends, because for a very long time, I knew them under their YouTube name and their Twitter handle and thought they were two of the coolest people I'd ever met on the internet. And it turns out it's just one of the coolest people on the internet. But I'll stop there and let you introduce whoever they are.
I was sitting there like, that's a nice compliment. Hey, wait a minute. No, and anyway. but yes, with the promo that was released for Tales of the Empire and all that, and you know, and you're all of a sudden you're looking at your calendar going, are we going to talk about this? You know, it's just, yeah, it is an embarrassment of riches. But our guest tonight is also an embarrassment of riches. That might be a compliment as well. I'll have to go back and play the tape again to hear that again. But with us for breakfast is, of course, friend of the show and returning Card Squadron winger number three, Frank Mulder, a.k.a. Mr. Daft Prawn from The Socials and the CWK Alliance. Frank, I want to welcome you back to the show, although I don't envy anyone's seat at the table or list of questions tonight for this double broadcast, because these are some very dark episodes. But welcome and thanks for coming back in.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. It's been a long time, so I think it's going to be fun. It's two cracking episodes, and I'm sure we're going to really sink our teeth into this. And everything you just mentioned that's coming over these next few weeks, wow. As we hear from time to time, what a time to be a Star Wars fan. We're in for a treat, or many.
I'm glad everyone is sitting down is what we're kind of getting at. Wherever you are when you're listening to us, I hope you're sitting down. But if you are joining us for the first time, this is an insert series podcast in the regular feed where Greg, Frank, and I are going to trade questions to each other about these episodes that we have not talked about before. Even in the pregame, which we didn't really record, we didn't talk about these questions. We talked about everything else, but not these questions. So there's a chance, kind of like a fantasy draft, that we could swipe one another's questions. So in this case, you better have some spares. However, comma, kooky theories, or a good cheat sheet, or a laminated sheet if you have one of those, is totally acceptable to bring to the table. And of course, you know, if you spill your coffee, having a laminated sheet of questions is probably a better thing. Anyway. However, comma, I'm going to remind anyone, if you haven't seen these episodes yet, this is a warning that there will be spoilers for this show and probably some speculation for the remaining four episodes. If you haven't watched yet, I invite you to please come back and listen after you've watched. Now, for this contest of questions, there are no points, bonuses, or lightning rounds, but there is the Greg's List, which we normally do, which is this season has been a little on or off, but these are a selection of podcasts and other assorted media we ingest to see if they have answered any of our questions and then some. It's also one of my favorite parts as it highlights just some of the amazing work being done out there in the community. We hope you check out some or all and maybe find a new content creator and hopefully want to support. Now, at this point, when we usually have like a guest come on, I would like to ask, you know, like let's just say present company excluded, because I'm hoping you listen. But can you talk about anything that you might have had a chance to over the season of The Bad Batch that you might have found yourself listening to? Maybe you've checked out something new, or maybe you've gone to a returning favorite that you haven't gone back to. But what has kind of kept you into The Batch this season, or at least kept it like after you watch, you're like, all right, I've got to go listen to read XYZ?
Okay, well, as you're off the table, you know, because like you say, you're always right at the top of that list. Of course, CWK, listen, Dan and Mason and all his guests this season have been absolutely fantastic. Colby on the Colby cast with Luke and Caleb, you know, or one or the other when they're available, have been excellent. A lot of the in-depth material you find out there as well, you know, like Jen's long take on these kind of things, are really a good way of maybe deepening or broadening the thoughts you've already had, or maybe just take you in a slightly different direction, which is why I always like to have conversations like we're going to have tonight. You know, the things that are in everyone's minds, it's great to be exposed to those. When it comes to this week's episodes, I've come in blind. I've wanted to make sure that what we speak of tonight is as fresh out of the mind and the mouth as it possibly can be.
Thank you. And it's kind of interesting, Greg, that was nice, like after the episodes we had with Asajj Ventress, it was really fun to go back and kind of, you know, especially when on vacation and whatnot, you know, and many long drives in Florida, getting a chance to kind of listen to some podcasts in general, you know, as you know, the wife and daughter, they were kind of doing their own phone things. And so, you know, having those like 1 to 2 hour deep dives from like, you know, Cantina Cast and whatnot, you know, Colby and CWK, it's really nice because you can really kind of sink your teeth in, and especially with a returning character like that. But Greg, have you been kind of like leaning into anything different recently, or old favorites?
I gave this new podcast a try. It's called Rebel Base Card, and a fantastic episode. I'm playing catch up on my podcast always, so I caught up on your Mark Newbold episode, which is like an hour 40, I think. It was a long chat, and it was masterful. I really enjoyed that conversation. So, you know, that was not really about Bad Batch, though Bad Batch came up and you talked about kind of happenings. But I just want to take the opportunity to embarrass you and tell listeners who maybe tune in just for these that Mark was on telling stories about going to visit Hoth itself. And you asked some great questions about that and about how he manages to cover everything on Fantha Tracks and everything they're up to. So that's a fantastic podcast hosted by, I guess I can say, my favorite podcast host of all time. So I encourage people to listen to that one.
Check is in the mail. but I would say, and it's one of the things I look forward to, like Mark has been on now, that was his fifth time. So I think he's one of the, other than like the folks who come back on the Breakfast Pack shows, I think he's one of my like, longest like returning guests or the ones that had the most appearances. But yeah, all you really have to do is just like on a topic, like whether it's Finsa or, you know, talking about the Acolyte, just because the man's been covering Star Wars for, you know, more than two decades and also has done a lot of writing before that. And so just knowing everything, it's just fantastic insight. Mainly it's just like, can you keep up with the questions? But I would say when I looked back at some of those other episodes he's been on, it runs around an hour 30. It's surprisingly consistent. Yeah, and you hear it like with him and Mark Mulcaster on Making Tracks, you know, if the Fantha Tracks fine family of podcasts should be on your playlist regardless. But thank you very much. It was very kind of you to say.
And I have one other shout out. Well, this is a little broad. So I am not listening to a lot of podcasts. Work has been crazy of late. So, and also my favorite band ever released a new album. So I'm listening to that in the car. So, I did want to just put a shout out. You know, we're recording this about a month out from Star Wars Day. And I know that Star Wars Day, doesn't mean that you have to go out and buy a lot of stuff, but it's when a lot of us go out and buy a lot of stuff. But I just want to put a shout out there to seek out some of the Star Wars fan creators that are out there putting out incredible kind of pins and stuff. And that's no disrespect to Disney and the things they're putting out. But I just want to say there's some incredible creativity. I've become a fan of putting enamel pins in a bulletin board or patches that I swear I'm going to sew onto something. And we have a lot of really great creators out there in the fan community. And throw them a little of your money, not just the Legos, not just the Hasbros, not just the Funkos. I say with a million Funkos over Frank's shoulder staring at me and one over my shoulder staring at me. You know, it is a fun part of Star Wars Day. Is you know, has Star Wars Day become too commercial? We'll fret later, but I think it's a good way to spread a little money around. So one of the things I did in that regard is there's a comic creator, a comic writer named Jody Hauser, who is she's currently the writer on the Thrawn comic book that's coming out right now, and she just finished the Obi-Wan Kenobi adaptation. And she's had a little health trouble. She's been open about it on her social media if you want to look her up. But she did sketch cards as a comic book writer. So they're hilarious and they're awesome. And there's a very funny one of Anakin angrily talking about how much he doesn't like sand. So people should, that's a great option. She has a Ko-fi on all her social media. It's Jody Hauser, as in house, like the building you live in, and an R at the end. So people should check that out.
I love the fact, and I think Frank would agree on this, that, you know, yes, you kind of expect a deluge of stuff that comes out on, you know, May the 4th, or, you know, like they keep trying to what the Imperial March or everything like that. But I love the fact of thinking local, just like, you know, like any good community where, like, hey, go to your local, you know, like, you know, music store or comic book store, when, especially because we're coming up on Free Comic Book Day. I think that's around that same weekend. But I love, like, you know, supporting, like, you know, everything from, like, you know, Left Coast Graphics to Nerd Matters to, you know, pick a commission, pick an artist, get a pin, get a patch, do something that's unique, that will be, you know, like, if you're thinking about scarcity, that stuff's going to be very limited. And, you know, and just support an artist, even if it's just like, you know, like throw a comment, throw a like on their page, let them know that they're doing some really awesome stuff. You know, Tracy Medina, TSM Art, just sent me some cards she was doing for the Garbage Chute Droids. They put out another set, and she was showing me, she sent me some of the cards that she'd done that got turned into base cards. And so I just wanted, just awesome. And, you know, nice, great little package kind of showing up. And then, of course, not to pat myself on the back, but we do have the swag pack series is done. The last two cards came in. So furiously making changes, 500 changes to the wrapper. So hopefully they'll be hitting the streets at C2E2 and some in the mail. I think it's the local stuff. I think it's the scratch built stuff that is some of my favorite. And love you for picking that for saying it as I'm stumbling to say the words.
Well, and Frank and Amy are two collectors I know who go for art prints and support artists. Any favorite artists that you like in particular to send people to, Frank?
So it's not so much particular artists, but when you were talking about the various outlets, which are very commercial, and the ones that are not so much, the very limited items, which are made by sometimes people like you or I, who are just incredibly gifted. I often take a look at somewhere like Etsy. Mm-hmm. It's remarkable what you find on there. I mean, over on my shoulders here, a couple of years ago, I bought a beautiful Ahsoka print, and mm-hmm. at no extra cost, the artist was happy to dedicate it, to sign it, you know, and that was just, please leave this in the message. So there's a lot of really very creative people out there, very, very talented people. So nothing specific, but there's more than you could possibly imagine out there. If you really take a minute just to look along lines that aren't the figures, that, like I say, aren't the Funkos, aren't those, every other store has them in hundreds, you can really find yourself some treasures.
Yeah, and especially like when I was putting together the Matt the Radar Technician outfit, Etsy's where I went to get the Matt badge as well as the first order patches, which the nice thing about that particular, I forget the Etsy creator, but you could get them, you could request them in other colors. And so, or like, the vinyl stickers, like I think for my previous car, it was black. I was like, hey, I need to get a first order vinyl one. Can you do one in white? And they're like, oh yeah, I can do one in white. Cause I wanted it on the black car. And, a lot of times, like you said, Frank, they're just more than happy to, do what they do and make a little scratch on it. And, it's really cool to be able to support them.
So even my Jetta robe, actually, that was an eBay purchase. Yeah. So, the robes that I like to wear from time to time, when they come out for an airing, that was an Etsy purchase. Again, beautiful, beautiful outfit. I couldn't be happier. And it was very creative, talented, capable person who had the vision to get all the materials together and create a little business for themselves. Yeah, excellent.
Etsy was the hero of our Star Wars Secret Wampa swap this year, yes. Our Christmas gift shop. It felt like every time there was a kind of showstopper gift where it was like, whoa, 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 what is that? Somebody said, well, I went on Etsy and found something a little more off the beaten path. So very good tip. Very good tip. I think there's a show to talk about, though, Greg.
Ah, this is way too much fun. All right. So as our guest, Frank, I'm going to put you to your list. And I want you to hit us with your first question of the breakfast.
Okay, so everything I've got is chronological, as we saw each episode in order. So we may wind up bouncing back and forth, as is typical. But the first thing I had a curiosity about was when we saw those opening scenes in episode 10, Identity Crisis. It was in a market town. There was people just going about the business, buying fruits and haggling over one thing or another. And we very rapidly discover a little baby who's kind of pottering around and getting into all sorts of trouble is force sensitive and force capable more so. And we have one person who's clearly, oh, this is interesting. Maybe with not the best of thoughts towards the child. It was clearly, well, it was a Aquilish, I believe it was. And, and then other citizens there who are like, keep it down, when they're talking about, oh, it's a cursed child, he's gifted. And this kind of back and forth between people who are apparently seeing a value in this person, this creature, and others that are more, we need to keep this down. I was curious, how far do you think at this point is the Empire's net being cast beyond trying to attract bounty hunters in? Like, is there a point where there is like a reward put out for tips? I know the bounty hunter that turns up in this instance does, drop a little change. Mm-hmm. But I'm just curious, how do you think that the galaxy is right now as a normal citizen who's not expecting to come across force users, but maybe there's money to be made and how that's being put around?
Very good question. I found myself asking a very similar question when I was watching that, because the fact that it's Cad Bane who goes, I kind of was immediately like, this is an Inquisitor's job. And then I was like, oh, wait, I don't think we have Inquisitors yet necessarily. And, in all the blessings of being a Star Wars fan we've been talking about, it does get a little confusing, right? That Rebels is a full, 15 years after Bad Batch, where we see a full Inquisitorius. And Kenobi is at least 10 years beyond where we are right now. So it's very interesting the way you were framing that to compare it to the Inquisitors showing up at the start of the first episode of Kenobi, right? Where they roll into town and everybody in the town is aware of who they are and what's going on, and that the Jedi is their target. So to me, it seems like we are at a very, very early stage of the Jedi children being hunted down. It would make sense that any child who had shown force ability before this this would have made it onto the list for the Jedi Temple and been, you know, recruited, hopefully a little more kindly than these bounty hunters do. But then when that ends at Order 66 and there is no more Jedi, I guess it would only make sense that the first step would be, you know, put out a bounty on children with Force abilities and have the bounty hunters, you know, bring them in for you, do the legwork, and then you can just control them. When we get to A New Hope and everybody seems to have forgotten about the Jedi, quote unquote, I do feel like that this might be a part of that puzzle. It's kind of one of those retconny things people complain about, that like, oh, it was 20 years ago and nobody remembers the Jedi. But it's like, if the children have been kept secret and anybody with Force abilities just gets disappeared, I think it isn't that hard to believe that the general population would stop ever talking about the Jedi and they would pass into myth a little bit. So the only other canon piece I want to connect to that is Cad Bane in this episode is very much in the same role as he was in his very first Clone Wars appearance, which was Children of the Jedi. I wrote it, Children of the Force. And in that one, if you both remember, if you saw it, there's a small baby that he goes and kidnaps because it's on a list of Force sensitive children that the Jedi had in a holocron. I think it's the first time we saw a holocron all those years ago. So it's curious to me that like, how long has this been going on? And is that just a sense that it is just the bounty hunters doing this work for the last, it's harder for me to measure that in universe, maybe 5 years between those two Cad Bane steals a baby moments. but I've rambled a bit. Greg, what do you think on this question?
Well, I kind of went back to that first episode of Kenobi where you see, you know, the Inquisitors kind of come off and they're really kind of like working that crowd. Now it's kind of interesting to see the attitude towards, I guess, you know, about 10 years, you know, 8 or 9, 10 years before. And then you start to think like, well, maybe if we kind of connect it to Rebels and thinking about those like HoloNet broadcasts where, you know, they're putting out. So I can imagine that post Order 66 and the organization, the Empire has probably done a lot of propaganda that has talked about, hey, if you see something, say something, as it were. So I can imagine that that's probably at least in the people's minds. Although I thought it was interesting that, you know, after he gets his, how do you not describe it as 30 pieces of silver? I mean, like it was like, okay, that's almost a dead on Judas thing right there, that was having kind of like second thoughts about it. And you're like, well, what did you think was going to happen? But you know, it's interesting to kind of see maybe the mindset of the folks now as sort of being like, yeah, I probably want to do that. Although like, you know, part of my first question was like, how do you contact a class one bounty hunter? I'm like, is there a 1-800 number or something like that? Where it's just like, you know, do they do commercials? You know, we're ready to believe you, as Ghostbusters still. but anyway, but that's kind of like what was going through my head, that, you know, like we do see a much more beaten down kind of folk by the time we get to the Kenobi one. But now it's sort of like, you know, I guess it also kind of depends upon, has the Empire visited your planet lately? Or have you kind of been in sort of like the, hey, we're pretty cool, or maybe we even were corporate, you know, controlled, where we don't get that hands on, that gloves on by the Empire. So maybe it hasn't gotten that bad yet. But I can also imagine that, you know, I kept thinking about like how much fee paid for gas, as opposed to how much, you know, they had to pay for how much the kid was charging for the information and things like that. So credit prices are still all over the table. So I'll be curious what he actually did make.
I will only interject that StarWars.com confirms that the signage in that hangar fee is in does say super and premium. So it is very similar to a gas station. So
perfect.
Instead of Buc-ee's, we'll call it
droids. Tackle your own question, Frank. I want to hear your thoughts on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was thinking the same thing, very much as you were. You know, let's say I'm assuming by this point that the purge is happened or is happening, you know. So as you said, as time passes, these believed to be Force users turn into myth, into legend. But it is still quite recent, you know, to Order 66. But it seems that as the galaxy gets more and more squeezed by the Empire, you know, they're always it gets brought up later on in this particular episode about the funds that the Empire has available for certain projects. You know, they're squeezing every system, every planet they go to, everything's being stripped for everything it's worth. So maybe that is an environment in which people do think, okay, I will take this easy money. It's a baby, it's a child, and maybe the money is enough to quell their conscience. What I thought were those two that were talking about, you know, keep it down, we mustn't be drawing attention to this thing, is that gets me back, like you've been talking, both talk about Kenobi, is the path has to have started somewhere. There has to have been some personal people that were interested in the well-being of these hunted beings, hunted people, whether they be Jedi or should they be Force sensitive individuals. It was funny what you mentioned there about Clone Wars as well, because one of the things I remembered about the episode Holocron Heist. So I was curious about what puts people at certain levels, or this like level one bounty hunter, and I think we'd all agree Cad Bane is definitely level one, if not like a one plus or one star. But we do see him in Holocron Heist working directly with Palpatine. I mean, it's through hologram, but he's working for the Emperor personally at that point. So there's definitely a connection there that can't be ignored, I don't think.
That's a really good point, and I'm gonna use this as my jumping off point for my first question. So, it was about halfway through this episode that I realized, like, wait, I think I've seen this before, and it was that Children of the Force episode of Clone Wars that I think is structured very similarly with, you know, a child that you see is Force sensitive. So, it took me back to where I was when that aired. I think that's the start of season two of Clone Wars, but some better expert would probably be able to date that specifically. And I remember at the time, there's a scene at the end of that episode where Palpatine, as a holocron, sorry, as a hologram, is walking through a room of cribs with babies in them, and it's on Mustafar, and it's like the world's most creepy nursery. And the hologram like is using droids to check in on these children. And way back when I saw that episode, my headspace was the person I thought of at the time was Mara Jade, right? The Emperor's Hand, who was a Legends character who was Force sensitive and was on the dark side and worked essentially as his assassin under the aegis of the Empire. And that is where I had theorized at the time. And so now I was like, my goodness, like, do we think, and here's finally the question, do we think that that was actually the start of these experiments? How long have these experiments on children been going on? Is the whole game to measure M counts and experiment with force sensitive blood? Is this some kind of form of the Inquisitorius? I guess we're getting a hint of that when we see Barriss's story, but my question is, you know, how long have these experiments been going on, and do you think it's all been just leading up to this, even back to like that early Clone Wars episode?
I love you brought this up. I had not connected those dots at all. But yeah, when you say that right now, it makes perfect sense. You know, to ask back in the Clone Wars, what was the end goal there? You know, was it just to find and kill, find and recruit? I love this thought that was perhaps what would have been the fledgling Project Necromancer. That's wonderful. Yeah, I didn't give that a thought at all. Definitely, I'm keeping that one in my canon from now on until I'm told otherwise.
I'm assuming you've heard the tragedy of Darth Plagueis the Wise. I think it goes back to Plagueis. I think that maybe Plagueis either put the bug in Papa Palp's ear, because I think doesn't he say actually talk about the midichlorians or had such a knowledge of the Force? So it might go back even before that time. It's maybe as like a Sith legend or something like that, that maybe Plagueis had, you know, a thought. Or sometimes, like when I have like a really good shower and all of a sudden the brain just starts firing all cylinders, and then you have to teams, you know, your boss right away going, hey, I got this thought, I'm just going to bookmark it right now. But I think it's been going on for quite some time, and I do, but as you can tell, with varied results, and obviously it's not easy to do. It's something that it seems to take lifetimes in order to work, and, or maybe not work. You know, that's kind of the interesting thing. Like as you get to Rise of Skywalker, Eric, you can mark it off your bingo card. We've talked about that tonight. that your results are going to vary, and you know, no, but I do think it's been going on for longer. I think it's been going on for a long time in various forms.
Yeah, and when you hear about the Project Necromancer, they're still trying to get some more repeatable success, it seems, in The Mandalorian. You know, we've seen there that kind of Shadow Council, and they're clearly still doing it this far on. And you mentioned, you know, some of Rise of Skywalker. When you know, we see that clone Palpatine and it's broken down and just not able to maintain. So I don't know how this is going to play out over this series and beyond. There's clearly going to be much more of this coming in the future, because it would seem that perfection is never reached, and what measures they go to between now and then to achieve that, you know, snatching up children and such, and about as bad as you can imagine a bad guy getting. But apparently Palpatine always manages to get one step worse.
Yeah, and that is exactly what I mean by, like, because we are experiencing all these stories so close together, you forget that it's a really long time, that Dr. Hemlock and Dr. Pershing are probably generation apart, right? Yeah. That they're not contemporaries. They, you know, if maybe Hemlock is Pershing's mentor, but certainly not his colleague and a peer. And so you are right. I keep having to remind myself of that when watching, and like, whatever we're about to see in the finale, I think has to give this project some kind of setback where they're really not there, you know, a full 25, 20, 30 years later. And then, like you said, add another 30 to get to a broken down Palpatine body, and you know, accidentally set loose Rey's dad along the way that created, you know, the end of that experiment as well. So it's really fascinating, and it's I don't always mean to sound like one of the old guys, but it's like, it's just mind-boggling that this is what Star Wars has become about. Like, it's such minutiae within this long, big story. And, you know, it's wonderful. I'm not criticizing it at all. And it's just really fun that Star Wars is this, but Star Wars is still Jedi swinging lightsabers and Wookiees and droids. Like, it's all of it. And it's just become so expansive. It's really fascinating. My answer to my own question, I think pretty much in the asking, I said my thoughts on it. I think what I've come to land on is this is totally separate from the Inquisitors, and the Inquisitors seem to, as far as we know, all be Jedi who fell to the dark side or were manipulated to fall to the dark side. The Grand Inquisitor, right, was a temple guard. You have we're seemingly going to see Barriss in Tales of the Empire, if people checked out that trailer, become an Inquisitor. The Inquisitor from Jedi Fallen Order, Greg, you never got this far, but she is a former Jedi who was betrayed by her master, or so she thinks, in Order 66 and went to the dark side. So it seems to me that we're not getting any hints that Palpatine has been raising these children to be his Inquisitor. So I hate to say it, because it's exactly what Frank said. It's dark. It's darker than you can imagine, but I think he's been using and eliminating these children for 10 years by this episode, and probably up through Grogu. And even if Din Djarin hadn't gone back, probably Grogu would have been sucked dry and tossed like so many clearance Grogu toys into the bin of history. So All right,
Not
that
want to
got
get
too
too far
dark.
off the track there. You're saying about Palpatine being that dark. I don't know if either of you have read the novelization of Revenge of the Sith, but there's a description of him, and it's almost like everything, life, light, every part of energy, it's just like a hole below him that just sucks everything in. And when you go through these processes we're seeing now, that just more emphasizes that. And Palpatine's a wonderfully creative character. I do love these nuances, despite how despicable he is. He's exquisitely nasty, and just love the guy. In for not the wrong reasons, I must add.
Oh, I've been staring at this list to see where I'm going to go first, because there's a couple three great starting points. I would say a great bit of speculation, which we can totally do on this podcast, would be, where does Project Necromancer end up at the end of Batch? Maybe we bookmark that for a little bit of foretelling, because it is kind of curious based on what you said, Greg. It's like, yes, it's going to be this project is not like linear. It's definitely going to have ebbs, flows, setbacks, and things like that. So it's like it'd be kind of curious. In the next four episodes, at least, are we going to see the first really major setback? But tell you what, all right, let me do this. I'll start off with this one, because and if we don't talk about some of the other things, I'll circle back. But I wanted to kind of talk about, because we have Frank on, Tarkin's bluff. Apparently, he doesn't know about Project Old Necromancer there. So, what was the point of showing how out of the loop Tarkin was on this project? Does it reinforce him taking control of Project Stardust from Director Krennic so soon after completion? I also wanted to give kind of a little bit of a shout out to Kyle Scully, a friend of the show, who kind of was leaning into some of this. But I am kind of curious about your feelings on how Tarkin was used in this, and to clearly show where he was in it. How do you feel about, does this kind of tie in? How do you feel about him being in this and where he's at?
It's funny you bring this up. I've got almost that word for word written on a piece of paper in front of me right now. And I wasn't sure. I mean, one possibility is compartmentalization, keeping all these things secret from one another. If one should become a vulnerability through capture or defection or whatever, they only know a part of the program. That was my first thought. So, like you say, you've got Krennic with celestial power. Now you've got Hemlock with Necromancer, and it does suggest that in Rogue One, once they have that the successful super laser test, if you want to call it that, on Jedha, that he's ready to take all the credit for that. So yeah, I was curious about the same thing. And when it came down to you're drawing out our purses, there's no real value in a pushback, especially once it's revealed, oh, this is a personal interest to the Emperor. And that was kind of Tarkin completely, put off of discussing any further. When we see him in A New Hope as Grand Moff, there's clearly been a lot that's happened between now and then. We saw him through the Clone Wars, and he is kind of a little cutthroat. He is willing to take advantage of any situation. But like you say, in this particular episode, he looked quite the opposite. It's like, where's this guy that apparently was calling the shots I'm accustomed to seeing? Where he's just brushed off with a, you don't need to worry about this, it's not your concern. So yeah, I mean, my first sort of compartmentalization, and that's kind of where I'm going to sit with this one, because you can't just be an accountant at this point.
That is very funny, because I would say this went 3 for 3 on our question list, although mine was much less generously worded. Mine was simply, why was Tarkin here? Because I do think it was an interesting question. Like, what story point does he serve, or what is he previewing? I would never accuse this show in particular of like a cameo of that, like, of that size as being totally inconsequential, right? Like, yes, we do kind of fan servicey things where we bring in Cad Bane and Fennec Shand and so on, but they are here to be a part of the plot and they stick around an episode, whereas this is just the quickest shout out. So to me, it felt like it was a seed planted and I couldn't exactly foresee what that seed was going to bear. And I think that that comment from Frank helped me a lot. And what I was just thinking about is the Sith, I guess it's not the Sith code, it's the rule of two, right? So Sith are always two, there are no more than less, one to hold the power and the other to crave it, right? Mm. And whereas Jedi are built around peace and justice and so on, Sith are born on competition. And if you are creating a government, then you want that, the one management style, if that is your value, is to get them all competing with each other all the time. And we saw that in Andor down to the base level, right? That I'm totally blanking on her name. The woman in the ISB.
Deidre Miro
is competing and they're scrambling over like the small data on different systems and who can do the most to impress the bureau chief who wants to impress Yularen, who wants to impress the emperor, right? And it's all a hierarchy and a kind of vicious game where they're all sniping at each other. So Frank's comments made me think like maybe the point of Tarkin being here is just to remind us that there's a vicious game going on here. And then the second piece of that is what you said, Frank, which is that, and if you thought Tarkin was, you know, the big bad who could put Vader in his place in A New Hope, this guy's a little ahead of Tarkin, at least at this moment, and a little further above. So that's a nice little bit of characterization to help us see this guy we maybe don't know that well yet, this Hemlock, that he's, you know, formidable.
It also is kind of interesting that it does a nice callback to evacuate in our moment of triumph. You know, when you really see, you know, Tarkin just like at the top of his game, not even thinking about his own safety at that point, because, you know, he's had, you know, whatever he's done between, oh, really? That's not my concern, to the fact of becoming a Grand Moff and going, you can sit down, Vader, or, you know, release him. It's a little bit of interesting, like it does kind of, to me, it plants a nice seed of like, oh, I better make sure that I get with all these different plans. You know, it's one thing to put Tarkin on the bridge of a Star Destroyer at the end of Revenge of the Sith, looking at the beginnings of the Star Destroyer or of the Death Star and just sort of assuming he's in on all the projects. But now it adds so much additional color that you go, okay, now Rogue One starts to make a little more sense, and you can, yeah, he's bad anyway. He's a bad guy anyway. But now, oh, you know, he's got an axe to grind or two. You know, woe be to the directors who are working on the different scientific projects out there in Empire Land. All right, Frank, what's the next one on your list?
Okay, so the next question I'm gonna bring up is. Is this vault that Hemlock speaks about, and what appears to be an inner vault? You know, we see Hemlock in some room very early on. It seems to be, it's not suspended above, but it's positioned above some kind of a chamber. And in the middle of that is, it looks like some kind of a Bacta tank. The second time I watch this, I listen to it through headphones, and you hear this kind of gurgling, bubbling breathing. It's quite clear when he sits to his desk that there is a person in there, a being of some kind. He has a data pad with an armor set, which looks familiar, but a helmet that does not. We spoke some time back about the Dark Trooper program when we spoke about Kenobi. Could this be another, like a, not even a version 1.0? of a Dark Trooper happening here, because it appears to be something different than a CX.
The other thing on my mind as you ask that question is, we do know Palpatine came here in the season premiere, right? And he went presumably all the way in. I, you know, there's no, One of my favorite non-Star Wars shows is Parks and Rec, and there's a joke where a character sets up a club, and there's the VIP room, and then the VIP room within the VIP room, and then the actually VIP area in the VIP room in the VIP room. So that's what you're describing, is the innermost VIP room where no one's allowed to go there but the Emperor. I do think that has to be probably the darkest secret in this place, and to move beyond children ripped from their families and told lies for scientific experimentation, you got to be thinking very, very dark places. So I would say Force sensitive troopers, which we debated at different times. These are something that has happened in video games that I think are all now legends. I don't think there's a current video game that uses Force sensitive stormtroopers. Or did the Emperor give a sample of his DNA and we are seeing a very early something related, right? I think Rise of Skywalker makes us think that an Emperor clone would just be old, really haggard Ian McDiarmid, but could it be young, nimble Palpatine in some killer armor? You know, maybe Matt Smith will finally get the gig he was rumored to have had for Rise of Skywalker. No idea if that there was any truth in that at all, but would love to see Matt Smith in Star Wars. So I think my mind probably goes a little more towards something related to the Emperor and or put in brackets Snoke, who I don't know how he fits into this. But I wouldn't take anything off the table. It's got to be bad. What do you think, Greg?
I think you need to go back to that tin you had of Dark Empire and pull out one of those covers by Dave Dorman of the young and surprisingly cut Emperor, you know, who didn't spare the six pack. I'm curious what the young Emperor's regiment was. But I do think that, because I don't know whether he'd be interested in making rivals, but I do think that, you know, if we can kind of maybe agree that the long-term play for the Emperor is just, yes.
It's very hard to see in my light scheme.
I like the fact that you have that metal card, you know, protected. That makes my heart sing. But I do think that it's less about making rivals, and the long term play is him basically making versions of himself. And I like what you brought up, Greg, where it's like, don't assume that a clone of Palpatine would be, you know, crusty, just got out of a very long shower, Palpatine, but a young buck. Who's ready to, you know, rule forever. And when this body runs out, I'll just crack open one of them, the six pack, and break out a new fresh body that's ready for it. That already comes with the lifetime gym membership or whatever they have in the Empire. But yeah, I think, you know, as much as I like the Dark Troopers, I think that is, you know, that is one thing, but I would say tops on the list has got to be young Emperor's the Young Emperor Chronicles. Sorry, I'm crossing my Lucasfilm streams.
Now I'll let those thoughts. You know, it would be absolutely expected of Lucasfilm Disney to do a misdirect. You know, true. Like I say, my thought went with this program of troopers that clearly a Hemlock's design. But I love the thought that this could be the first iteration of a Palpatine clone, and what would be interesting is if at some point in the future we do see, I mean, you said a six pack, but how about if there was like a Palpatine clone would last 3 months, and it was just a rotating stock of new bodies? I don't know how practical that would be or how realistic that would be given the science that's going on right now, but that's great.
Is that sort of like the Emperor version of like Hello Fresh or Emperor Fresh, where it's like every 3 months a new Emperor comes to your doorstep and you just crack open the box and there he is. He's ready
to
go.
The Imperial subscription program. That'd be it.
These subscriptions have really gotten out of hand now. it's funny.
Oh, man, I could go on and on. Because then it makes me think about... you know, is Gideon already out there somewhere, right? Gideon's pretty old by Mando. No disrespect to Giancarlo, but right, he's got some gray hairs. He's not a young man. So I wonder if you know, we do have some of those programs out and about. And the fact that we saw in Bad Batch Kamino get destroyed, it seems clear to me that cloning tubes is what they used to be called in Legends. I don't know if they're called that in canon. This is a controlled technology now. Whatever knowledge was out there now entirely belongs to Palpatine and perhaps to this facility, which links into that question of where does this project get to by the end of this? Well, I know we have a whole second episode we need to talk about, so I will make this my last question about this first one, which is, I think probably the point of this episode was to show us Emery and Emery's journey from diehard, you know, committed to the cause, and to maybe some questioning. So I guess my question is, and it's a little bit of speculation, but like, will Dr. Emery make the right choice before this season is up? Is she going to be a key to success in some way, or is her, seeming transformation going to be too little too late?
I do think that, I think she's got to be kingmaker in this. And I think maybe the assistance early on, or at least not really, you know, putting her, allowing kind of Omega to kind of make it out of there, I think probably is a little foreshadowing that, because at this point, you know, Omega's going to be back at old Mount Tantus. You know, is a frontal assault really going to really do the trick, considering they still don't even know how to get to Mount Tantus, or they're going to have to find out real quick. So they're going to need someone on the inside, and it just kind of makes sense that I think showing the little kids and Emery, and that Emery has a bit of a heart. I really kind of liked, what did she say? Like, is that what you're going to do to me? Or cast off like I was when she was having that moment with Nala Se. So I do think that I think she gets to be Kingmaker at some point.
That conversation with Nala Say, that's really interesting. One of the things that stuck out to me in the exchange was when Emery tells Nala Say that she doesn't have the power, she doesn't have the ability to help these kids or to make what would be the right choices that you're speaking about here. And Nala Say says, "Don't you?" That's a little bit okay. So your Omega sister, as we're told, as it's presented, we now know that at least to M count, Omega is exceptional. Does this mean that Emery is also a high M count candidate? The thing that would make me think perhaps not is, wouldn't she have been tested if she was also a clone that was brought into this facility to work for Hemlock and the Empire? It seems like that would have been a bad move to put someone that would potentially be a victim ultimately. So I'm not sure if she is, like you're saying about this kingmaking, she absolutely could be in the exact right position to make things go very badly on Tantis. That escape attempt, I was curious about as well. You know, for some kid to try and do that, some little kid, I know he's desperate. You know, they're all saying they want to go home. But for him to have done that, it made me start to wonder about just how locked down and secretive Tantis is within Tantis. You know, Crosshair and Omega made it out. You know, does that information kind of unintentionally move around that facility? You know, and encourage people to maybe try the same thing. Like I said, a bit of a stretch, I think. But Emery certainly has been, she suggests years working for Hemlock. And when he decides that, you want to be chief scientist, he doesn't blink an eye. So either he's incredibly naive to what her real motives could be going from this point. You know, she seems to be all business most of the time. But if there is something behind that and she does start to feel more compassionate towards these children that she has some kind of connection with, maybe that's what's going to wind up being Hemlock's undoing.
Mm. What do you think, Dr. Kess?
I hope so. Right? I mean, I think I want so much from her, and both of your comments made me realize we still don't know a lot about how Dr. Emery came to be, right? Was she on Kamino? Has she always been on Mount Tantus? This loyalty to Hemlock, good reminder of that they have been working together a long time. And is she the only other one, or are there more female clones from Django's genetic stock around? And boy, I have a lot of questions about that. And, you know, it's all just a reminder that it seems like everything is pointing towards a big showdown in 4 episodes, right? 2 and then a 2-episode finale. Is that the schedule we have going?
I thought it was.
Or is
it,
they're all 4 separate?
I think it's, you know what, because I think when they originally put it out, I don't remember seeing a date, at least in the information I had about, I only had the 1 episode, but now it makes sense that they're so.
Let's see, we would have, this week was the 3rd, so it would be the 10th, the 17th, and then I think 24th, and then I think it ends Star Wars week, so they maybe are all spread out. But there's just not a lot of time left, and I agree with what was just said. Like, a big frontal assault doesn't seem to be on the table right now. Even if they got all their clones together, doesn't seem like you have enough. So is it going to be a stealth infiltration? Is it, how can we do this? I'm nervous and I'm scared, and all the good influencers who got everything except the finale, I believe, and are saying things like, you're not ready. That just makes me more anxious and scared, but I can't wait for it. So, yeah, I think she's going to play a key part. I'm hoping that's for the good.
It's interesting what you say there. You know, for Star Wars, all of Star Wars, there is nothing I have found more nerve-wracking than this season so far. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it was that initial escape from Tantus, on the edge of my seat, you know, I've never been so invested in a character or a pair of characters or a group of characters getting to where they're planning to go and, you know, making the Empire look foolish. So this is beautiful storytelling every step of the way. And this season has, if it's going to get worse than this, I don't drink yet.
Well, and just to that point, I want to point out, as I assume we're wrapping up talk about the first episode, this is a series first where there's no member of the Batch, current or past, in this episode. We have shifted away from the Batch to Crosshair before, but we really only see Dr. Emery and some other clones are the closest we get to the Bad Batch. So really interesting, and unlike when an episode of Mandalorian suddenly focused on Pershing and people complained a lot, I didn't hear complaints this time, and I don't know if it slipped people's notice or they were just so engrossed by what was pretty emotional storytelling, only to be followed immediately by something even more emotional and dark. So,
hey, let me bridge this into the next episode with just a stem of a question. Cause I was going through if there was any of mine left from the first one, but I was curious, you know, when Cad Bane met, Emery on what looked like Space Dock, from the Star Trek franchise, the planet behind looked to me like Coruscant. Did that strike, you know, and this is one of those things I thought was infuriating is like, you know, yes, if you're going to put these episodes out early in the morning, I'm going to have to watch them on my phone, which means when I watch them, hopefully again on the big screen before we get a chance to talk, then you go, oh my God, where was all this detail? And I'm sitting here doing this, you know, at 5 o'clock in the morning going, is this really the best thing you can do for me at this point, Disney Plus? But I was just wondering, was that kind of the consensus with everybody, that it looked to me like Coruscant when you actually saw it, and that it was probably just neutral ground? I was just wondering, like, hey, we can put any planet back there. Let's just do Coruscant. Anything before I kind of move on to the... I didn't know.
The only thought I did have was that craft that came in to pick up that bounty was the same type that, I believe, anyway, the same type that was in season 2 carrying that Zillow Beast. the infant one. So like you mentioned, it's off of Coruscant, so neutral in that way. But if it's above Coruscant, it's very much not neutral at all. It's right above the Empire's throne. So that could be a place where is a direct link between Tantiss and Coruscant. Maybe those are two points that they never stop between. You know, we've already had the Zilibis incident on Coruscant all those years ago in Clone Wars. So maybe that's a standard drop off pickup point.
Yeah, it's not like they're gonna take him to Tantiss, right, and drop off there.
Right. Yeah. And you'd think as well, if Palpatine and, like I said, the heart of the Empire is Coruscant, there's not going to be a lot of danger, I don't think. Or we certainly see the Empire ignore danger again and again and again. So they probably think, oh, it's fine. Just bring them on here. No one's going to mess with us. This is where everything's going on.
I didn't clock it as Coruscant, but I will just use that to make a larger point that the planets we pop into, Frank was talking about the opening planet a little earlier too, like these are very fun, like they have character and they give you just a little taste even if you don't get to stay there long. I also just want to make sure we note the force sensitive baby was very adorable, and a return of a Solo alien, which people may not remember, but this little alien species is a Tarlafar. And the first time we see one is over Han's shoulder in the initial Sabacc game with Lando on the kind of snowy planet, I believe, the Hunter's Lodge type location. So I know I think that probably also means he was in the Denny's cards because that is where a lot of those aliens come from. And maybe the Denny's commercial.
Gonna have to go back to the cards. Darn it, Greg, you got me. I know where I'm going later. Scratch off Solo off your bingo card if you had that on there. All right. Yeah, that was, like I said, it was just kind of a stem, but one of those things like we'll never know. But the question I did kind of want to get to. All right. To what is the show title Point of No Return referring to, with the exception, of course, of the 1977 album by Kansas, which you can't see in Podland, but it is my background tonight. Point of No Return, a classic Kansas album. That's a little shout out to some of the older folks in our audience and thread, all the 14 or 15 people who listen to this. But I am not going to pick on Colby because I know he's he may be a little too young for this. I was a little too young for this album when it first came out. But as far as like my Desert Island vinyl list, I still have this vinyl, and this is one of those, like, the first Asia album that you'll pretty much have to claw out of my cold, dead hands, because the artwork is so darn awesome. But I am kind of curious, what do you think Point of No Return means?
Wow, that's totally
throwing Frank under the bus.
I'm familiar with this situation from a while back, asking about Reaver and Vader. So I've been here before. It's an interesting one. I was thinking about the titles of both, and before watching both, I had very different ideas about what those titles might have meant. This one, I know it's skipping very much to the back end of the second episode, it seems to be Omega's choice, especially the way it goes. I'm wondering how early in that episode does she make that decision, or has she been getting there for a little while? More than once we've heard her say, people are getting hurt and it's because of me. They're looking for me. And this one time, you know, there's a situation that is not going well for anybody involved. So for her to make that choice to, I mean, it's all sacrifice is one of the great themes through all of Star Wars. And it's not a sacrifice of life, but it's certainly a sacrifice of freedom and her own safety, a sacrifice of the things that she loves, the things she likes to be around, especially on Pabu. She's got her family, she's got her friends and all the comforts that at least for a time were there. I think the point of no return is that moment when she presents herself to the troopers and surrenders to that CX trooper. I can't see, for me watching, it could mean anything else.
Mm. Great.
So I'm waiting to be told otherwise.
I was going to say, yeah, that now he threw me under the bus, saying no other answers are valid, but go ahead, give another answer.
Good luck with that, Greg.
You know, I think that is the correct answer, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, in internet speak, I would say this episode is we've left the F around stage and we're in the find out stage. And the consequences of the Bad Batch are coming back around. And I'll just say, since this is as we start to talk about this, I had a deep foreboding feeling as soon as they were putting the treasures in the place, because I was like, there's a reason they're setting up that these things are not on the Marauder, right? Like it kind of rang that alarm bell. On Mandalorian, when we lost the Razor Crest, it just happened to be able to pick up the little silver ball afterwards. But I think this was clearly like, oh no, like we're not turning around. So I am interpreting it as Omega's choice to not let anybody else die on her behalf. But I also think that this is a major turning point in the story of the Bad Batch. And we've said before, they're kind of jumping around to adventure, to just trying to survive, to subsist, to take care of themselves. And I think this is the point of no return for that lifestyle. And it's folded up with Omega, which is that the Emperor, and this goes all the way back to Frank's first question, the Empire has grown so powerful that there is no escaping this. And this is not going to go the way they think anymore, and their only choice is to finally confront these forces. And you know, I think the episode also demonstrated that the Bad Batch, is as great as they are, they're not ready for this fight. They are just totally out well, I'll go to Hamilton, outgunned, outmanned, something, and outplanned, right? And I think that this episode was all about that it only took one smart trooper to track them down and turn their whole world upside down. And I really do feel like it's a point of no return for this show, that everything now is just streaming right towards the finale and the conflict to come. And I think it's a coin flip for every single character on who survives this. I don't think there's anybody safe.
Yeah, including the HasLab project for the Havoc Marauder, which I think you can completely take off the table. I was just very happy. And, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, you know, when you're doing animation, you know, everything is, you know, laid out. There's nothing left to chance. There's not like, you know, there's not like the guy that accidentally gets in the shot of the Mandalorian in the background that gets wiped out later. But in this case, you know, who was happy to see Gonki clearly saved? Yeah. And let's give it up to Wrecker for basically not even thinking about it, grabbed Gonki and saved, because like, if anything, if you would have laid odds who lasts longer, Gonki or the Havoc Marauder, I would have been real curious about that prop bet. If we're all now eventually being sponsored by DraftKings at some point, when are we going to get the Bad Batch prop bets? But at this point, I agree with what you're saying, Greg. I do think that, you know, it was a point of no return, especially for the residents of Pabu, because, you know, you're listening to the mayor kind of go off and going, you really don't have an idea what's going on, especially when he said, you know, you're destroying our livelihood. I'm like, and the operatives go on like, I stopped there, or like, I don't have to stop there. I can keep going. And I'm like, I bet you as we get into the beginning minutes of the next episode, yeah, you're going to see it get a lot harder, because now you've still left, you know, there's still some cleanup left to do on aisle 5, as it were, in Pabu, or pretty much cleanup on Pabu, as that's going to be. And that's going to get really messy, unfortunately. But yeah, I couldn't have said it better myself, Greg. I do think we are at a point of no return, with apologies to Kansas. We've gone past this. No more. There's no more of the Bad Batch that we all know and love. It's going to get really wild from here on out. And this is clearly showing we're at the end of whatever the Bad Batch was that we thought it was.
Right. It's that one safe haven they seem to have gone as well. You know, and even in the past, you say about the Havoc Marauder being destroyed, it's been referred to as home. So their refuge is gone. Their home is gone. I don't know what hope would be left for a group so so beaten down to this point. It's going to be rough for Pabu, and maybe that's the reason we don't hear about them later on. We say that about a lot of things that just don't come up later.
All righty.
I want to give a shout out on that note, both to my good friend Carl over at Wampa's Lair. He posted a picture today of, I think it's the Hot Wheels models of the Razor Crest and the Havoc Marauder. And he said, you know, a tribute to two homely ships. And what I laughed about that is homely works in the British version and the American version there. Those are not particularly attractive ships in the American sense of the world. But I think he meant it in the British sense, which is two ships that were homes and were cozy. And I do think, you know, what comes to mind except Omega's little space, like, right? Her little room there, yeah. Her nook. And that's gone. These characters are unmoored now and untethered. You know, I have some questions about the doll made it out, but also the goggles. And I'm going to save my question about the goggles for my turn. I think it's Frank's turn, though.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, as we were talking there about that point, no return, one thing did pop back to mind, which is, I mean, one of the questions I put down, like we just said, Omega's taken. She's gone. She's let herself go. Hunters crashed into the ocean on a gunship that the CX trooper shot the pilot of. Crosshair did his best to try and get a tracker onto that CX trooper's ship, but wound up engaged by troopers along the way. It was kind of I'm sure it was a very intentional little plop into the water as that tracker just a little splash in the ocean. And it makes me concerned about what Crosshair's future might be. Mm. So we've got, he was left with Omega. We already had Hauser some time ago who was softening towards him, but like, are you still kind of somewhat sympathetic to the Empire that you were with for such a long time? The several past episodes would suggest he's back in the family. He's back as a part of the batch. But now that he was the one that was kind of left to look after her and she's gone, could that change? Whether it be from Hunter, for Echo, for Hauser, whoever, are they going to be charitable enough to believe that it was beyond my control?
Yeah, that did take one of mine off the table. I'm glad you brought this up, Frank.
I didn't have that exactly. I did want to just note, I think it was very subtle, but I'm mainly going to give credit to former guests of the show, Jen and PT, my long take review co-hosts, threw this around our group chat for that show, which is that it seems that Crosshair didn't make the shot, and they both interpreted that is his shaky hand, right? That Crosshair should have made that shot to get the tracker on the ship, but he couldn't have. And I love that interpretation, and I'm just not sure that the show gave us enough that we can say for sure that that was there. And maybe it's intentional to make it ambiguous or not. But it is very heartbreaking to think about. He's been struggling. He's been trying so hard. And in that moment, which I think we kind of predicted some previous episode, that he would have to make a shot and miss. Maybe this was it, and she's gone. So my version of this that is getting taken, I wrote down, and I think this gives away my answer. I wrote down who will be the most driven to go get Omega, because I think it's usually Hunter who leads the, like, we have to go get her. And my heart says Crosshair is going to be more desperate now, because he's going to take this burden on himself. He's going to blame himself, and he's going to want to track her down as the kind of apotheosis of this journey they've been on, where the two of them have gotten closer all season. I did not even think about how bad this looks for him from the outside, from the perspective of those characters you're mentioning. And especially because you would have to start bringing in Hauser and Rex and Echo, who all kind of had misgivings about him, if you're going to make this assault on Mount Tantus. Boy, I wasn't nervous before, but you've made me very nervous for Crosshair. So I hope they believe him, but I think it's a very real possibility they don't.
I'm glad you kind of left on that, because my point in that is that, as you know, because I had a very similar one where it's like, oh no, would Crosshair and Hunter have a falling out over the plans of Omega? Because now it's only on Crosshair to say, hey, it's up to her. But I would say that what is in our corner, what's in Crosshair's corner, is that there's 4 episodes left. And I don't think there's going to be enough time for them to kind of go to hash this out. If there was a whole nother season, you could be like, okay, we're back. We're going to be back and coming to blows. And I do think that it will be a very short scene of this where they will have a bit of a confrontation, but I like that Greg provided the out going. I think that if Crosshair is kind of shown to be more beating up himself, then, you know, it's like, you know, like somebody hit me, you know, like, then I do think that we move past that. Because yeah, it'd be really heartbreaking to have all that work, all that you know, all the work on the character, and everybody kind of, you know, like giving him back now. But I do think that he becomes this may be setting him up, and I think we've talked about this before about, you know, Crosshair maybe having the big redemption arc where he has to sacrifice himself at some point for the greater good. And maybe this is what prompts him. Maybe that he's just so like, I can't believe that that he's just now hell bent. And, you know, because, you know, we still haven't seen, and we haven't even got to this yet, probably, maybe not, like, there's still a piece of the trailer we have not seen. We have not seen, you know, Fee and that scene with Fee and Hunter Wrecker, and we don't see anybody else in that one. They're on the big, you know, tractor trailer thing, whatever, moving. So it is kind of interesting, but I do think, Greg, you provide us the way out, so we don't necessarily have to waste too much screen time on this. I think now Crosshair's on a mission from God, to kind of quote the Blues Brothers. All right.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, from me as a viewpoint, I trust Crosshair. I believe he has come back. I believe he wants to be in the family again. He's trying. Like you're mentioning, when Omega was presenting him, well, I can do this. There's this idea. There's this idea. He was coming back with, no, that's terrible. There's this you're not thinking about. He was doing everything he could to talk her out of it. So we've seen that without a doubt. In fact, when you bring trackers up, one of the first thoughts I had while I was watching was, do they still have one of those CX tracker chips handy? You know, she just put a comm in her pocket, you know, easily detectable. I wonder if they've got that they took out that six a few weeks back, but clearly not, and here we are. So I hope it goes well for Crosshair. Like you said, that redemption arc, it's such a strange thing, because he has been all of this time, until like the last couple of hours worth of content here, the most unlikable character. I mean, clearly written that way, performed that way, to just be as unpleasant as could possibly be. Dismissive of everything, not ever cracking a smile, and now we're discussing hope Crosshair's okay. I mean, talk about,
as you go polish off your statue of tech that you have behind, yeah. You're like, no, I can't deal with two of these right now.
That's too much.
Oh, well, I'm walking through that door. All right, so I know you listen, Frank, so you know that my theory way back when, I still think there is more going on with CX2 than we have learned. He's exceptionally good at his job, and we get that, and we are meant to remember him. I think the previous appearance, I noted how he survived when you could so easily... What did you say about Palpatine's crack another one off the six-pack of CX troopers if you needed to? So I continued my tinfoil hat theory. There's a reason why you saved the goggles. There's a reason why it's this guy. I don't know. I still think this might be tech, but as it has been pointed out many times, it's going to happen quick if it happens quick. So I would love the two of you to reflect on my previous tinfoil hat theory. Do you think it's still possible? Do you think it's something that could be there? Or should I just give up hope and this is just another clone?
It can't be another clone. The whole reason that person's there. And, you know, if you think about it, I'm going to take, you know, like, kind of like dive into, or kind of like side into one of my characters. Because if you think about, we've got, you know, Dr. Carr, we've got the operative, we got Commander Wolf, we got Rex and Echo, and you've got all these other characters out there that, you know what, it's gotta be him. I don't think you kind of keep bringing this up, you know, other than the fact that we never really have a memorial type episode. No. So I think they haven't put that character to bed. And I think, you know, if we're not ready, if all the influencers are saying you better sit your butt down, I'm ready for one of those. I am ready to yield to my content overlords that say, you know, here you go. And then, you know, of course, Frank's going to take the model of text down a couple of shelves and go, all right, put you over there for now.
Oh, you two are both so awful. I thought this was going to be a fun night. Oh, gosh.
Okay. So you're not coming back for the Acolyte is what you're saying.
Gosh. I'm going to make it through the night. The problem with what you're both saying is I can't dismiss it. I really can't. You're saying about that trinket shelf where Lula wound up and the goggles, it was, to me, it was a visual. Hey, remember this guy in case you'd forgotten? I every time I watch that CX trooper, that operative, I'm listening to him really closely. I'm watching how he moves really closely. And there are little things. Funny enough, this last episode, I thought he sounded a little like Crosshair.
Thank you.
Of all things. But there was that episode when Rex and that big old compound, I don't remember the name of the planet, the one from the original Clone Wars movie, was attacked. And, you know, and you see the CX trooper limping around and it thinks, oh gosh, I remember Tick breaking his leg and having a problem like this, limping around with his busted leg in season two. There's these just little similarities, and I mean they're very, very subtle. I think what's been kind of in the invisible ink, as many would call it, is it's gotta be. I'm halfway expecting like an Anakin Vader helmet kind of thing going on here. I mean, I don't think it's going to be a reveal of himself. It seems like it's going to be something far more tragic than that. I'm not sure if they could get Tech to a point where it's like, hey, it's me, deal with it. I don't think that's what they've done with the character. I think that makes anything that's tragic minimized. There is often that problem that people talk about, you know, if they bring a character back, does that, you know, does that diminish the sacrifice that was originally given? And that's a fair argument, absolutely a fair argument. But I don't think in all cases, I think maybe if this does turn out to be Tech and he is the one who's recovered his sister and taken her back to Tantis and whatever that may mean for her, that's even worse. I'm sure both of you remember off the top of my head, who was it in one of the series or movies said that there are some things far worse than death. And maybe this is that thing that's far worse than death.
Yeah, because if it was...
Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, because if it was just a clone of Crosshair, then we'd have a whole Scarlet Spider thing going, and nobody likes that. There you go. I guarantee you we're the only Star Wars podcast that brought in a Scarlet Spider reference for a reason. But I'm sorry, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say I was curious, so I did a very fast Google. I wanted to know just if anybody else is asking this question, because I am not as present on social media as I was at one time. And I did see that immediately a Screen Rant article popped up kind of trying to walk through the clues and parse it out. And I would say, you know, in Screen Rant fashion, they stretched it into 27 pages when they had a paragraph's worth of material. But the best clue they seem to offer is that CX2 in this episode referred to home as domicile, which is something Tech did. back in previous episodes. So maybe there's a little language tick there. But I would say nothing conclusive there on the internet. And good to know we're not the only ones thinking about it. And I love your joke, Frank, about this was going to be a fun night. And you're right. And I would say that's the space it occupies in my mind, is that the only way I see this working out is still incredibly tragically. It's hard to imagine, you know, I'm thinking of Phantom Menace, because we're in that year. They blow up the control ship and suddenly CX2 slumps over, reboots, and tech comes out. Like, that just doesn't happen, right? So I think it has to be, like you're saying, something worse than death. And that is not what I wanted for tech. If it's him and they can rehabilitate him, you know, I'm thinking of Bucky Barnes in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, right? Like, you know, they pull the Winter Soldier out and deprogram him and so on. Like, maybe there's, but we only have 4 episodes. So if anything, I think they maybe could potentially save him, but it would be somewhere else we'd need for the story to go on.
Well, like Bucky Barnes, perhaps after season 3 is finished, there'll be a Tech Goes to Wakanda.
I'm there for that crossover.
Omega and the Winter Soldier. There you go. There's your tail. What do we have left in the tank? My list is getting down.
The one I do still have is the Trandoshan was mentioned. After season 2 and Sid selling out the batch, she left kind of looking very crestfallen and like, oh dear, I've done something terrible here. But apparently they're still getting information from her. So is she on the payroll of the Empire, or is she a prisoner?
I didn't even think of that. Shoot, that went completely over me. It's like, yeah, like,
I mean, she has more connections to the batch than anyone else that the Empire, I believe, has on their radar.
And is still friendly with Fee, for all we know. The souring of the relationship didn't seem to make Fee turn. Just because we're late in the season, I'm starting to think like, oh, I kind of wish we got more of Fee, because it was fun being with her at the start of this episode. And I don't know if you don't hire Wanda Sykes every week because it's a little pricey, but it would be nice to spend a little more time seeing what their relationship with her is. But it doesn't seem as close as Sid and they were. I guess this is a podcast where we hope for redemption. It'd be nice to have Sid do something redemptive along the way, because you want to believe they have a soul, but I don't know.
I don't think there's enough time left. I think that's the problem, Greg. There's so many threads at this point that I think with the next 4 episodes, I mean, if they stick the landing. They can't do it with the Marauder, but they can stick the landing with another ship. That, you know, it'll be an incredible job of taking all these loose threads that they've put out there and coming down, unless, you know, you're going to have some kind of spinoff thing. But I didn't even dawn on me that when they said Trandoshan, that it was Sid. I'm like, yeah, that makes complete sense.
Well, you mentioned that part that we've not seen yet from the trailer, which is Fee on that big old juggernaut looking thing. And, you know, beyond the batch, beyond the clones, she maybe has the one with the most motivation. There seemed to be telegraphed a kind of a romantic connection to Tech.
True.
Well, the Empire killed her, killed him, as far as she knows. You've got Pabu now in flames. That was the place that she seemingly called home, or certainly, again, just like the batch did, somewhere that was a safe haven, a paradise to return to when she wasn't off liberating ancient wonders. So I do think Fee probably has some motivation to really want to kick off when it comes to the Empire.
And that comment is just a reminder to me that I was so wrapped up in Omega and losing Omega at the end of this episode. It really stunned me to think about, this was a very Empire Strikes Back ending for all the characters, right? Like, we have a lot hanging in the air. The very clear threat to Pabu. I had down, like, what suffering lies ahead for Pabu. I think that doesn't need to be answered because it's speculative at best. But there's a clear threat that they are being blamed for harboring these fugitives. And there was some part of my mind later in the day that's like, oh, well, it all resolved. And then I'm like, oh, no, there are still Star Destroyers hanging over that island when we leave this episode. And yes, they've gotten their main prize, but the clones are all still there and seemingly still going to be targeted. I mean, does the Empire, they don't tend to go house to house and find just the people they want. They tend to burn down the village or blow up the island. So I like this point. And then I'll only add that I did look up the release schedule. So it's one episode each for the next 4 weeks is okay. Correct. Next week is actually called Juggernaut, which Frank just invoked, right? Because that's what that tank is called in the familiar sense. So I think that'll be the end of the trailer material. And they'll probably sneak out a trailer for the last three episodes. They tend to do something like that. Oh, so. Man.
All right. Do you have anything left, or can we get to Pringle Scans ratings?
There was just one more thing. It's a very little detail. And that was where the Six Troopers ship landed. Was that the same cave as Ventress's? For a moment there, when he left, I was wondering, is Ventress still around? Are we going to see Ventress save the day by just hanging around nearby? Clearly not. It was just a brief thought, but it was just interesting that Ventress apparently chose either a very good cave or maybe it's just the only secluded cave that is available on Pabu. So,
well, that's a kind also, of throwaway. Well, no, that leads into sort of one of my small questions, like what good is an alarm if nobody's around to get notified by it? I'm like, all that stuff that they're got on their armor and things. So the alarm on the ship, and by the way, you're in an island, a circular island in the middle of nowhere. Who didn't see like all these ships kind of come in? No one's really looking up. I mean, you know, obviously we've got the eclipse next week where everybody have to make sure to wear your glasses and you want to look up without protection, things like
that. Tech goggles.
Yep. Your tech goggles, right? but I'm telling you, who's looking up? Who's seeing this stuff? Nobody notices these ships coming in at any rate. But that's all I really had.
I guess I should have gone Emery glasses because they're closer. The Eclipse glasses are closer to Dr. Emery's glasses probably than Tech's. No disrespect intended. Very good points. Certainly. I mean, I think there's a narrative convenience there. But also, I think we're seeing the Bad Batch got complacent. So back to Point of No Return, dropping the audio right here. Oh, yeah, that's a tasty groove. Nice job, Greg. Sounds so good. So good. I would say, you know, another way is their complacency is over. They are going to pay a price for it, and they got happy there. I will just, before we go to Pringles cans, give a couple quick shout outs to Canon Connections, which could also this week be called Greg Read the Episode Guide on StarWars.com, because I didn't have much. But shout out to the clone recruits, though, who are getting snow cones. That one I did catch. And the Fee uses a droid tube, just like the Jawas do in A New Hope, which was fantastic. And Greg, you previewed this one. You earlier in our conversation, maybe before we got on air, said, Matt Lanter, what's he up to these days? Matt Lanter guest starred in this episode as Oily, the droid at the service station, was Matt Lanter's voice doing a little cameo. I'm sure was in studio for some of that good Anakin work he's done of late, and just threw a little fun voice in. So always good when he pops up.
And at a convention near you, I'm sure, with Ashley Eckstein and you know, all the good folks from the Clone Wars. All right. Frank, I think he'll lead it all.
Because we're a highly influential podcast, let's get Michelle Ang out to conventions too. She should, I would show up for an Omega autograph, and I want that out there in the world because I don't think she circulates as much as the others and deserves to be lauded in that same way. I think she did sign at Celebration Anaheim, if I'm not mistaken. She was at least there.
At least there. At this point, why are you not getting in on the money? Put it this way, it's like you already earned it. Three seasons with Bad Batch, but yeah, get in on some of that and be one of the first on your block to pull down that Michelle Ang autograph. All right. Are we gonna do the episodes together or separate? What do you think there, Dr. Cass?
I say separate.
Okay, fair enough.
Double rating.
Double rating. All right, Frank, what are your Pringles cans rating for episodes 10 and 11?
Okay, I'm going to give them 9 apiece. I don't mind the slower character-driven pieces at all. So I really enjoyed seeing Emery in her environment and what that meant to her. So, and then, like you say, the excitement, the tragedy, the stress of the second episode. So 9 apiece from me. 9 Pringle cans apiece.
I am going to separate them because I feel like I have to justify saying we had to separate them. I'm going to go, this is surprising myself as I'm saying this, but I'm going to go slightly higher on the first. I'm going to go 9.5 on the first one. I thought that was incredibly compelling and dark. And, you know, I have never liked the fans who say I want R-rated Star Wars, but I want mature Star Wars. And this was mature. Actually, my good friend Carl texted me right away. He's like, are you watching this with your son? Like, how can he handle this? And my son quit Bad Batch a little while ago on me. But it would be hard to watch with an 8-year-old is how old Henry is. And I'll give the second one a 9. And I believe we have not always remembered to give Pringles cans rating. But these would be number 1 and 2 on my season ranking. These were the best this season has been so far. What about you, Greg?
I think I'm gonna agree with you folks. I'm gonna go 9 and 9 across. I do think that they handled some very darker tones very well, and I do think it's interesting where everything gets ended up. You know, it's one of those things that all the worst case scenarios have started to happen, and I do think that, you know, that they did a really great job with these, you know, introducing the Force sensitive children and how, you know, like they didn't hold back about, you know, Cad Bane basically stealing kids still, and all this. So it's, you know, and all that's happening to Babu and what's left in our minds to imagine what happens, since we are not on the list of the folks who get the advanced screeners. My excitement for what's to come and dread is right up there. So I'm gonna leave it both at 9. These are great episodes. Great episodes. All right. Well, as we kind of bring this to a close, I did want to say thanks once again for Frank for joining us tonight. Like I said, no easy task. You held up your part of the bargain quite well. But I wanted to know any final thoughts and where people can find you online.
Final thought is, with Pringles cans ratings, if tech does turn up later, is that a demerit? Does that go up?
You can take your rating back down if it turns out to be tech.
That's the important thing.
I will allow it.
And I'm on Instagram, Mr. Darth Prawn, also on Blue Sky. Don't use quite so much, but get on when I can. Mrs. Darth Prawn, my wife Amy, and myself also paint Star Wars rocks. We got an account, SW Rocks 77. That's SWROX 77. When we travel around, go to cons, we do a little bit of art, just leave them around for people to find. Hope it's a bright spot in a day for them. So that's where we are.
Perfect. All right. And you, Dr. Cash?
First I'm going to admit, when I saw your recent post on Star Wars rocks, I believe it was an Ahsoka helmet clone. And yeah. I think if I'm remembering correctly, you put it down outside a shop in Paris. Yeah. My first instinct was like, can I get to Paris? And just, they're really beautiful creations. And, you know, we started this show talking about fans with secret little passion projects. And, you know, the fact that you could make a killing on Etsy, but instead do it as, hey, let me just brighten up the joy of somebody's day and so on. That's really great. I have a High Republic one from Star Wars Rocks that's right back there on my shelf. I'm not going to jump up and get it because this is an audio podcast. Hey, I'm on the internet. My name is Ion Cannon everywhere, EYEONCANON. This week, I just want to plug in particular, we did a small break after the Oscars on my movie show with Jen Subchakchai, The Long Take Review. But this week's episode, we call a hype draft. And so if you've wanted to try out our show but don't think you go to the movies enough, this is us predicting the rest of the year and doing essentially a fantasy sports draft of the projects we're most excited about. And so myself and the other three hosts, we all got to draft four movies that we're excited about in the rest of the year. And I will just say I'm very pleased with the four I got. It was fun because I learned a lot about, just from the other three hosts, different movies that are coming out. And I added things to my watch list and different fun projects coming out. When you get all four of us, you have some highbrow taste, some lowbrow taste, some action taste, and some nerd taste. So it's kind of all over. And so it's a real fun way to try that show out. So that's the Long Take Review podcast, available wherever you get fine podcasts, including YouTube, which all of a sudden we're doing killer numbers on. I don't know. Sweet. We got to get Rebel Base Card up on YouTube as well.
I know. And what I would say, what I love most about the Long Take Review podcast is the fact that you've got it's the group that I think that makes it so strong. It's like everybody kind of comes in, because there are a lot of movies, as we have found when you guys went through Oscar season and all the different awards and things like that. But yeah, what a great jumping on point. And I do think that's a great thing for a podcast to do every now and then. It's kind of do a bit of a reset and welcome new guests. You know, like I said, for the 16 people who listen to this podcast, we want to thank you because you've been along for the ride. It's fun every now and then. You just kind of, it's a good idea to kind of let people know if someone's relatively new, going, hey, this is what the show's all about. And I also want to thank the folks, Kyle and Sam and all those folks, Sal Berry, who also send in comments and questions. They're really nice, and I love the feedback. And by the way, you're also on that Through the Glass Columns podcast, that Wheel of Time podcast, where you'll be reading Wheel of Time till you die, basically. Because I think this series goes that long. But at any rate, if you have questions for us, you can hit us on the socials, Twitter, Instagram, X, Facebook, Threads, Blue Sky, and Hive at Rebel Base Card. I did want to very quickly, before we sign off tonight, I promised you an obscure nugget for Point of No Return. But what I loved most about it was every now and then when you do deep dives, right? Everybody takes the Google searches for granted. But I went back, and because, like I said, Point of No Return, 1977 Kansas album, has the famous track Dust in the Wind. And if you're of a certain generation, it's almost an iconic, almost like a, yeah, it's not even a, it's just a song on its own. But the Wikipedia entry for Dust in the Wind has this great little humor nugget, and I'll read it verbatim from Wikipedia. Now, Kerry Livgren devised what would be the guitar line for Dust in the Wind. If we can think about Dust in the Wind, has an iconic acoustic guitar line. He did it basically as a finger exercise to learn finger picking. Now, go listen to the song, and you'll pick it up. But his wife, Vicky, said he heard what he was doing, remarked that the melody was nice, and encouraged him to write lyrics for it. And he said he wasn't sure whether or not his fellow band members would like it, since it's kind of departure from their kind of like classic 70s rock style. And so after Kansas had rehearsed all the songs intended for the upcoming release in the summer of 1976, he pulls out this song and plays it for his bandmates. Now, can you imagine hearing Dust in the Wind for the first time? And what I love is the line is basically the bandmates, who after a moment of stunned silence said, "Kerry, where's this song been?" Sort of like one of those things like, where the hell did you get this thing from? This is amazing. And so I thought that one of those things where I just kind of laughed out loud reading it. I'm like, who thought Wikipedia is your source for humor? But it's one of those things like you never quite know until you kind of like tell someone or let someone know that you might have a gem. And can you imagine? Newer generations don't listen to some of this stuff, but it is one of those things where it's like, if you're of a certain age, like, can you imagine a world without Dust in the Wind and Point of No Return? So anyway, that was just your fun little nugget for all three or four of you who are still listening at this point. And of course, at this point, I have to say, I wanted to thank again Frank Mulder for joining us. And for Frank, Greg Cass, and myself, we're going to return you now to your podcast playlist, already in progress. This podcast is not affiliated in any way with Topps, Disney, or Star Wars, nor is it endorsed by Disney or Lucasfilm, and is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only. All names and sounds and any other related items are properties of their respective trademarks and or copyright holders here in the U.S. and abroad. The official Star Wars website can be found
at www.starwars.com.
That's it. Limber up.